Let's have a quorum of city council, please.
Tom Grease. Aaron Ward, here.
Mayor Hayes, present.
Don Cryer, present.
Mayor Dennis Scott. Full city council, how about a quorum for planning commission?
Mary Hatfield.
Kathy Egan.
Russell Spann.
John Cameron.
And the planning commission here, minus Norm. Okay, pledge allegiance. Come on, Jake. He likes it.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, Corey, any added agenda items?
No added agenda items, Mr. Mayor.
Public comments. Ladies?
Kitty Shields, 51540 Shields Drive. I'd just like to say I was really glad to see what's on the agenda today, because I think all too often people come into these positions with very little, if any, guidance on what their roles are, what the limitations and latitudes are, and that's just not a good thing on many levels. And it's also unfair to each of the individuals, any individual who experiences that. So yeah, I was really glad to see that on the agenda, and I'd like to extend my personal thanks to any and all of you who saw the need for that and are making it happen. Thank you. I look forward to a good session and all of us walking out of here feeling very good today.
Happy. Yes.
Happy.
Colleen? Good. Okay, we got a couple dates. We got approved minutes on February 8th, February 22nd. Did everybody read them, get a copy?
These were the minutes that we had it at the regular meeting last week. And there were some issues with the transcript, so we made some edits and revisions, and they're here today.
I move we approve the consent agenda.
It's just these minutes, approval of minutes from February 8th and February 22nd.
Just minutes.
I'll second that.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Unanimous. Minutes approved. Those two dates. Okay. We have. Let's go around the table and introduce everybody, because there's some new people here. I'll start. Maybe give how long you've been on or something. I'm Dennis Scott. I'm the mayor. I've only been mayor since January. I was on the council a year before that.
Mr. Martinez, I think this is my fourth year. I don't know.
No.
No?
No, but it's like six.
Six?
But who's counting?
Okay, six. Was that including the first round?
Probably not.
Probably not. I was your first mayor on the first city council, stepped down for a while, took a little time off, and then decided to come back. And so, yeah, it's been a while. It's been a fun ride.
And, you're old.
I know it. I'm starting to feel it, too. But I tell myself I'm not.
Yes. Karen Ward. I've been on the council for about 3 years. I first was appointed to the council, and then I ran for my seat and got elected. I really like what I do. I enjoy all of it. Thank you.
Tom Grease, and I have been on the council since January. So, Brandon.
Jeremy Green, attorney. Alan Dill is an attorney with our office as well, that being Bryant, Loveland, and Jarvis. And we've been with the city since inception, more or less, correct, Kitty? 2005?
Yes, 2006.
2006, so we've been involved with the city for quite some time and have enjoyed every minute of it, with some minor exceptions. No, I'm just kidding. But glad to be here.
Good. Like Jeremy said, I'm Alan Dale, and I assist Jeremy with the municipal work that we do at Bryant, Loveland, Jarvis. So I'll be working with you off and on through Jeremy and on through the future.
John Cameron, Planning Commission. I think this is day 8. So I've got a fair amount of experience thus far.
Yes.
But I intend to be learning quite a bit, and I'm looking forward to it.
Russ Smith, I've been on since December last year, so I'm one of the old times.
Yeah. Kathy Agin, 5 years with City Council and about 3 months commission.
Mary Hatfield, and I've been on since January. Wanted to get away from doing things with kids, and this is great. All adults.
Tom Craner, I was on the City Council for about 3 years, and I laid off. I was elected this last term, so I'm back on.
Jake Obers, Public Works Manager, almost a year.
Corey Misley, former intern, assistant city manager for about the last 8-9 months.
We had another gentleman walk in here, so
I'm sorry.
Introduce him to
you. Economic Development for Set of Oregon for Senator Little Time.
Okay.
Then I guess I'm turning it. Oops.
Sorry.
Guys don't always have to include me in these things.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Ashley Williams, and I have been here 8 years. Oh. And I was really impressed when Jeremy said there were some tough times and he didn't look at me.
Okay, I guess it's up to you, Jeremy.
Great. Do you mind if we dim the lights just a little?
I'll do that right now, and I'm going to pass hard copies around.
So good afternoon, everyone. As I said, my name is Jeremy Green. This is Allendale. We are both municipal real estate business attorneys with Bryant, Loveland, and Jarvis. Corey and I, while discussing various city matters, I'd say a couple months ago, discussed the idea of perhaps come down here and putting on a little dog and pony show as it relates to council rules, public meetings, and ethics. What we have found, and we've done a similar presentation with other municipalities that we represent, what we found is that some of these items or issues that we cover, either councilors and commission members were not aware of or didn't necessarily have a firm grasp as it relates to the depth of the issues that exist with respect to council roles, public meetings, and ethics. And so really this is an informal presentation, meaning I'd like dialogue between us to the extent you have questions for me, comments, chime in at any time, interrupt us. But what we're wanting to do is establish some very basic foundations, if you will, as it relates to these three areas, and put you, hopefully, as Kitty suggested, in a more comfortable position, moving forward as you act within your respective roles and capacities. So with that being said, we'll kick this presentation off. If I can get this thing turned. There we go. So our roadmap, we're going to first cover council roles, then we're going to move into public meetings, laws and regs, and then ultimately into ethics. Starting with council roles, within this category, we're going to discuss the council manager structure, the general role of the council, that is as a body, communications with staff, and liability and lessons. So under the council manager structure, the 2011 city charter sets up our management structure as the council and the city manager immediately underneath the council. Essentially, the city manager serves as the CEO of the municipality, meaning the city manager is responsible for the day-to-day operations and administration of the city. The city council, in contrast, is responsible for general policy development. Council establishes policy. That policy then is implemented by virtue of direction given to the city manager. And the city manager then is responsible for proper and appropriate implementation, whether that's by presenting appropriate ordinances to the council for adoption, or resolutions or simple motions. But that is the intended hierarchy structure. And this gives you a visual aid, if you will, of the structure. So the voters elect the city council, the city council hires the manager, and then the manager hires its staff, its city administration. And then in reverse, the city administration reports to the city manager reports to the council, and then of course, ultimately the council reports to its voters. Want to start with that one?
So what we'll delve into now a little bit is some of the roles between the city manager and also the city council. And the last slide, or the slide before the last two, mentioned that the success of the relationship balances on the roles and the respective roles of each. So looking at the city manager and some of the functions of the city manager, the manager has the overall authority to hire, fire, organize, set administrative policy, and implement ordinances, policies, and goals of the city. And this includes things such as preparing the budget for council's consideration, recruiting, hiring, supervising staff, serving as the council's chief advisor, and also carrying out those council policies. On the other hand, so the council, if you think about it, is the legislative making body of the city, and its members are the decision makers. As the chart mentioned, the councilors are elected to the council. You're not elected necessarily to an independent seat. So you collectively, and I apologize that this presentation might be focused on council rather than council and planning commission, but the council is the decision-making body as a whole, not each individual. And you'll develop the policies that direct the operations of the city, and then the city manager will carry out those policies.
So the forms of taking action, as I noted previously, you could take action by virtue of an ordinance, which is legislation, is municipal legislation. A resolution, which is, in my mind, a good way to think about a resolution. It's a way to formalize more or less a motion. And then you've got your quasi-judicial decisions, and then motions and consensus. So general role of the council, these are things that I believe are perhaps already well understood, but to go over them briefly, you all are to focus on big picture. The council members are designed, the council seat, so to speak, is designed to focus on community goals, major projects, long-term considerations such as land use development, capital improvement projects, capital financing. You serve as a liaison between the boards and commissions. You maintain, or you, not in the detail, so to speak, but you ensure that the city is put in a position where you've got a developed and acceptable budget. And then Corey, as the city manager, is responsible for implementation of the budget, ensuring that the expenditures and receipt of funds are consistent with the budget that you all develop. And then, of course, you serve as a local contract review board, and that's more or less legal jargon. Basically, you approve contracts. Corey is responsible for going out and soliciting those contracts, getting the best proposals perhaps possible. You all then put your local contract review board hat on and award the contracts, presumably based upon the recommendations of city staff.
Jerry?
Yes.
When you say put on the other hat, that kind of kicked me back to the general role of the council.
Yes.
And you have the ordinance resolution,
yes.
Quasi-judicial. Could you explain what those last two are?
Let me go back to the slide. Motions and consensus.
And the quasi-judicial. I don't think a lot of people understand what that role means.
Quasi-judicial would be something that predominantly comes up in the land use context. When you all are approving or making decisions on land use driven issues. Whereas motions and consensus, motion would be, let's say you are presented with an expenditure perhaps, or maybe you are asked to support a particular, how do I put it? You all are often asked to support letters of support, correct, as a council, as a body. Let's say, for lack of a better example, the Boys and Girls Club comes in here and they want you to support their program of collecting Christmas trees or something to that effect. Presumably, rather than reach consensus, you will ask for a motion to approve the support of that particular Boys and Girls Club program. And then consensus is basically a nodding of the head, is the way that I articulate that. It's when you all basically agree that this is the direction we want to go, or we want to support this particular decision without taking a formal action. And the appropriateness of the particular action is highly dependent upon what's being presented. Your TPM ordinance as it relates to medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, that's a legislative action and therefore it should be captured in an ordinance. A resolution could be the establishment of fees. For example, so often your business license, well, your business license ordinance, for example, establishes a fee within the ordinance, but it allows changes to the business license fee by virtue of resolution. Why is that important? Well, the hurdle or the standards associated with an ordinance, the procedural components are much more stringent and difficult relative to a resolution. As you know, your charter specifies in great detail what prerequisites have to be met before an ordinance can be adopted. Those prereqs are much more cumbersome than it would be on a resolution. So again, what is appropriate as far as what form of action is appropriate is dependent upon the issue.
And I believe quasi-judicial has only happened once.
It's very rare.
City.
Yeah.
And that is when it's called up to the council from a decision.
On a land use decision,
on
correct.
On a land use decision.
Yes.
And there's certain requirements that as a council we cannot.
No bias.
Yeah.
There's what I was going to say is more often than not in our cities you see quasi-judicial decisions in land use are with the planning commission.
Exactly.
And fortunately, in some regards, there's a state statute that specifies how those hearings go. And if you think about council as a legislative body, when you're doing a quasi-judicial action, it's kind of a combination between being a judge and being a legislator. And you've got to take this criteria from your code and you're applying it in a certain circumstance. And the state has set forth how that hearing occurs. So that's, like you said, for council, it's probably rare that you'll see those come up to you, but planning commission often will hear those more. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. And we've done quite a few of those in the last handful of months. That's when really have the formal public hearing, proponents, mm-hmm. opponents' views, and I think Alan said it well. You're sort of you're interpreting the code and interpreting the criteria that's in our comprehensive plan, and then weighing in on a decision whether to ultimately recommend it
yes.
to council.
Well, you say that we've done that over the last couple of months, but in reality, we've only been together as a group here for about 2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Well, we'll have one next Thursday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure we will.
Hence yeah. the reason why it's called quasi-judicial. It's because of the fact that you're acting more in a judiciary capacity rather than a legislative capacity. So in the disclosures that Alan was referring to are statutory mandates, and it's really dealing with such things as having communications with the proponents or opponents prior to the hearing itself. You have circulated, presumably, when you're having these hearings, the required disclosures and what have you.
And there's a statement read at the beginning of the hearing.
Yeah,
asks
we put a script together.
Good.
Tammy, our contract planner, takes care of it.
Is that adequate, Stu, or do you want... Okay. So we covered this one. Four basic roles for counselors in connecting with citizens and their government. Yeah, so again, I apologize if this seems very basic or elementary, but basically, as you all know, and I believe this goes with the Planning Commission as well, your models for the disclosure, or discourse rather, between our citizens and the city itself. I wouldn't say obligated because that suggests that there's some type of legal imposition, but in my mind, you're to set an example on behalf of the city with respect to your citizens. If I'm on the, whether it be the Planning Commission, the Budget Committee, or the City Council, I believe the public holds you up to a higher standard than just the average citizen, and so you should conduct yourself accordingly when in public. Let me give you more of a straight pointed example. When folks ask of your opinion with respect to city business or city direction, if you are critical, and not that you can't be critical of the direction the city is going, but what you communicate to the public, oftentimes the public are going to associate that opinion as being the city's opinion as a whole. And so I think it's very important that you keep that in mind when you're out amongst, you know, your peers and the citizens at the shopping center, at the local coffee shop and what have you, that regardless of the fact that you might be speaking on your individual behalf, folks are going to often construe that as to be the position of the city. And so one thing that I would suggest is, to the extent that you do have a diverging opinion from what perhaps might be the direction of the city as a whole, you make sure that you clearly articulate that to the citizen as well, that the city is going this direction, although you may not have supported that particular direction or decision. The reality is, that's the direction of the city. And I think you do have an obligation to, in large part, put the city in the most favorable light possible.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is that sort of like with the president, that when you're out and about, as according to what you feel, you will always say, it's our president and we will stand behind him with the city?
Yeah, I think so. It's more of a respect component than it is anything else. And again, identifying specifically where it's your viewpoint and the viewpoint of the city so that you don't confuse members of the public.
Okay.
Yes.
I would think cannabis is a big example of that, because you have a private opinion, but the city stands.
Sure. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Educators, you're often asked about the position of the city. You're often asked about, interpretation of ordinances or land use decisions, perhaps land use code provisions. Frankly, members of the public are going to assume, when you communicate in response to inquiries, that what you say is the law or is the interpretation of the ordinance. So you need to keep that in mind as well. Don't ever be afraid to say, hey, you know what, great question. I don't really know the answer to that. Let me route you to our city manager, Corey. And Corey will be glad to follow up with you. Because again, the members of the public, and it's the same for the Planning Commission, they assume that when you speak, it is the law or it is the status of the city. Wouldn't you agree, Kitty?
Yes.
Listeners, you know, it's obviously critically important for you to be a good listener with the citizens. I don't think you can be effective in your respective roles or positions unless you are a good listener. And then, of course, leadership. Leadership is assumed, I believe, but as council members, you are the leaders of the community and the leaders of the city.
So shifting gears a little bit now into the relationship between council and the city staff, I've drawn from your council rules, the city council rules, a few points that kind of highlight how you make sure to distinguish that relationship and how it also impacts the relationship with the city manager. So for example, the council members will respect the separation between policymaking, you all, and administration by, among other things, not attempting to influence or coerce the city manager concerning personnel, concerning his administration, his staff, etc., or the purchasing rules, which will come up in the local contract review board, which we discussed. Another one is addressing all inquiries and requests of staff to the city manager or to the city attorney, and allow reasonable time for responding to that. Moving on, another thing to keep in mind is to limit your contacts with individual staff. And of course, you work with the city manager, work with Corey, and if Corey okays it and Corey's comfortable with it, that's one thing. But in general, looking at your rules, it's a better practice for you all to limit those individual conflict or contacts with the city officers and staff so as not to undermine that authority of the city manager. You don't want to be, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but you don't want the perception of going behind the city manager to staff. So, and finally, which will come up a little bit more when we talk about executive session, but make sure to honor the confidentiality of the discussions with the city attorney. More often than not, we'll have those discussions, or that will come up in executive session, but also when you have one-on-one contacts with the city manager, or pardon me, the city attorney's office.
So this next slide is something that it addresses an issue that comes up with virtually all of our cities, and that is communications between the council and city employees. It is, again, critically important that council members allow city staff to do their job. And in particular, as it relates to the city manager relationship with the city council, it's important to make sure that we keep our roles separate and distinct. because if we begin to mush those roles, so to speak, it creates complications for the city manager to be effective and efficient, and likewise it puts you all, as we'll go through here shortly, in a position of compromise and potential liability exposure as well. I'm thinking here, in the last 2 or 3 years, there's at least have been a handful of situations in our office where we've dealt with counselors perhaps going too far into the staff relations and creating complications with relationships not just between the council and staff, but staff and the city manager or city administrator. We're currently dealing with one, as we speak, with one of our cities that unfortunately may wind up in litigation. My recommendation is that if you've got concerns or issues with, for example, a staff administration, department head, that you communicate it to the city manager, in this case, Corey, and then allow Corey to go through the process that Corey identifies as necessary or appropriate to resolve that particular issue, rather than communicate with that staff member directly. So getting to the slide, however, the city employee is responsible to his or her immediate supervisor and does not take orders from the counselor. Each counselor has authority in administrative matters only to the extent delegated by the council as a whole. We'll pause there. That's another really important principle to understand. You all, and this goes with the Planning Commission as well, as individual counselors, you have zero authority. It's the body that has the authority. So unless you collectively agree to go in a particular direction, there is no decision made, and there is no authority in the individual itself. Does that make sense to everybody? Job performance and other personnel related concerns regarding specific employees should be directed to the city manager, of course. When a counselor decides to discipline, direct, and otherwise address personnel issues, the counselor risks the following, and this is what we were talking about. You risk the potential of claims against the city, such as harassment, retaliation. We are always concerned about, we meaning the attorneys, are concerned about communications, written communications, emails. We've had situations where individual counselors have addressed staff directly via email, which then creates a public record. But these communications are such that they have, they're fraught with potential underlying legal issues, and in the event of a public records request, it's very possible that the bulletin or other publication could get copies of those records, which could put us in a compromising or jeopardizing problematic situation, to say the least. It undermines the city manager authority, in my opinion, which often compromises the ability for the city manager to be effective, is when the city manager says A, B, and C to a staff member, and then we have a counselor who comes in and says C, D, and F. And the staff member, notwithstanding the fact that the staff member doesn't speak directly to the council, the staff member is put in a position, a compromising position, because regardless if you're their boss or not, they're going to feel like they need to respond to you and adhere to your direction and guidance. However, undermines then the city manager's ability to be effective, because he's dealing with, or she's dealing with, competing interests, the interests of the counselor and his interests or her interests as well. Does that all make sense? Mm-hmm. If I'm going too fast or I'm not articulating it well, by all means stop me and ask for clarification. And then negative public perception, again, to draw on personal experience, oftentimes, particularly in smaller communities like the City of La Pine, City of Sisters, John Day, you know, some of the cities that we represent, the tension internally with staff members, it gets out in the community. And in my opinion, it can be extremely damaging to city operations if the community is aware of the conflict, the internal conflict that's going on. Alan, you want to take that one?
Moving on now to liability, as far as the public official's liability. This is governed by the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and in essence, what it says is when you are acting within your official duty, the public body will defend and hold you harmless, save harmless, for your actions when you're acting in that capacity, in your official capacity. The exception is where you're acting in malfeasance or willful, wanton, neglect of duty, which is basically outside the scope of your duties. There are also liability issues that come out of federal civil rights law, common law of torts, and specific statutes, which will go in the next, the next slide will cover some of these. So some of the statutes, and we'll cover a few of these later, where you might find some personal liability, is the budget law violations, and conflicts of interest and ethics violations, and I think probably the large portion of personal liability that a counselor or a planning commissioner might face will come from those, as well as the last one, the public meeting law and public records law, which we'll cover in detail later. Actions outside the scope of official duty, which I briefly mentioned, unauthorized expenditure of public funds, malfeasance in office, and then public contracting violations, and again, the public meetings law.
And so to clarify, oftentimes we get asked from individual counselors, where are we potentially subject to liability and exposure? And Alan has identified, you know, a few areas of which, notwithstanding your official capacity as a counselor, notwithstanding that you might be acting in your official capacity as a counselor, these are areas where you run the risk of having exposure despite the protections that might otherwise exist. As long as you act within your scope and capacity and in accordance with applicable law, the likelihood of you having individual exposure is very slim.
So this, many of you probably may have read about this. This happened last year or the year before. This kind of summarizes just a lot of what we just discussed about you're now a leader in the community, you're now going to be, there's going to be a little more public scrutiny, but as this case, this is true, as this shows, it not only affected the individual counselor in this issue, but the whole city as a whole had to deal with this firestorm of the fallout of what this one counselor posted on their Facebook. And it was a very inappropriate repost of an inappropriate video. And as I mentioned, the counselor resigned following. There was backlash throughout the community. It was statewide backlash. And it makes it very difficult for the city, and it definitely gives a black eye to the city.
So before we move on to public meetings, laws, and regs, any questions about council roles?
I guess I was thinking, what are something that's come up lately is like letters of support that we've been asked to sign, and what are the like legal ramifications of signing them, not signing them? I mean,
as a collective body.
Well, obviously.
Well, the reason why I ask is because there was a time, and I think the city actually specifically ran into issues where individual counselors were signing letters of support without full council support. Not well before your time. But letters of support, you know, generally speaking, there aren't a lot of issues with it. I mean, if it's a good program, if it serves the citizens' best interests and that of the city, and the council is fully supportive of it, it's great. Go for it. You know, it should just be analyzed and reviewed on a case-by-case basis. Clearly, if a group that had some type of motivation that was questionable, one of perhaps discrimination, you're not going to want to support it, not only because of the political reasons, but also because of the potential legal issues associated with that. But in general, my thought is that if it's a legitimate good program, you present it to the council, get the support of the council, and then authorize the mayor to execute the letter and move on. It happens all the
time. It's sort of like the Boys and Girls Club came to us and asked us to support them, and we signed. That would be okay.
Absolutely.
Would we have to have all the other councilors to sign before we did?
Oh, you're saying as a planning commission?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know of too many situations or instances where a planning commission has been asked.
But I mean, if they just come and asked us to support them, knowing that we're on the planning commission.
Yeah, I would probably route it to the council, because the council would be the more appropriate body to provide those letters of support. I'll tell you, when it comes to the planning commission, you all are a unique hybrid, so to speak, particularly clearly when it comes to land use driven issues. I would always be careful in supporting things as a body. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate, but B, just because you may be asked to support something that ultimately has some type of land use or development implication, and then you've just somewhat compromised your position to review that particular land use issue.
Good answer.
And so I would be very careful and trepidatious, and I would suggest, and maybe this is something that you and the council should discuss, but my recommendation would be don't support things, always run them through the council, and if the council feels it's necessary for you to support it as a commission as well, then the commission, or excuse me, the council can give you that directive.
And that's, are you asking as the boy next door comes over and wants your support for something just because you know him. Very personal and know him, and you can't do that?
Yeah.
Just to see it clarify where we're at with that.
Yeah. It's a great question, and related issue, somewhat related issue. When you all are considering or reviewing a land use issue, in my opinion, and I don't know what your practice or your policy is now, but I don't believe you should be having communications with the council on those pending issues. And so it comes up often. We get it in our office all the time from commissioners asking whether or not we can, the commissioners can have discussion with the council members about a land use issue being presented. I say no. Because again, you want to keep that independence. And if there is an appeal or a review by the council, you've somewhat compromised their impartiality by virtue of those communications.
Well, that brings up another thing. It's like, I've talked to different mayors, city managers, it's like 50-50 whether a council should go to a planning board meeting.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I went to them, and now I stopped going to them.
So the safe answer would be case by case. However, I would tell you that in my opinion, stay away from it. There's no need for you to do it. Because ultimately, if you're going to review it and you're going to hear the particular issue, you're going to get a staff report and you're going to have information as far as what was presented to the commissioners and what information was used when the commissioners rendered their decision in your packets, in your materials. And frankly, you can always ask questions to get further information during your council meeting. So I think, again, it impairs potentially your objectivity by seeing it and participating directly or indirectly in those planning commission meetings.
So
long-winded answer, I'm sorry, but that's my
opinion. No, that's good. Been open the air on that one.
Yeah.
I never even thought of that.
Do you disagree?
No, not at all. That's complete agreement.
Corey, what do you think?
That would be my recommendation. I mean, I think ultimately case by case, depending on the issue and exposure, but the best rule of thumb would be just if you're not there, then there's no potential issue.
Then you can't be
misled
by us. That's right.
Would that be also for like the planning sitting in on the commission's meetings?
The council meetings?
Okay. Uh-huh.
At that point, it should have already been kicked.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You would have been done with your review.
Okay.
And so sitting in on that meeting, I wouldn't have an objection to it.
Okay.
I wouldn't think that would be the problem. It'd be the other way
that's
around.
Correct. Okay. That's when
in case I hear an argument going back and forth, and that's going to taint something.
Yeah.
I may not get the full story. Or
I guess the way I look at it is, let's get back to the process. The idea, the premise of the process is two independent levels of review. And if you have council members participating at the planning commission level, again, directly or indirectly, you've compromised that process.
Right.
Yeah,
this is good. You're answering our questions. The answers.
You bet.
Well, I like the idea that with the planning commission can go and give the council brief.
There you go.
That's I mean, the exception to the city manager, though.
That's different.
Staff.
Definitely, yeah. He's got to be there.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, it might be that they may call upon the city manager to provide additional information.
Yeah.
And having that knowledge or an awareness might ultimately be helpful.
I got a quick one, Jeremy, following up on the question regarding letter of support. You might touch a little bit on this with that handy case in terms of what you're just going to go through meetings.
We're going to
public meetings.
Yep.
But I got a request from an organization in the community that I think everyone would support, and it was on very short notice from their grant writer. They said, hey, here's a template, letter of support. It doesn't directly impact the city, but we'd love to have the city showing support for this. You know, can you get it back to me by Friday? And it was like Tuesday. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So very short notice, not ideal. What I did was send it out to the council via email, the draft letter, and specifically told them not to hit reply all, but to let me know individually whether they were okay with this or in support of this or had any objections to sending the letter of support. And so through that, I got what felt to me like consensus to send the letter, and then the mayor signed it and we sent it. Do you, I mean, that is not an ideal scenario. I'd like to bring it to, you know, a month heads up, take it to a work session, take it to maybe even a regular session for, like you said, a motion to approve that. Where's that fall on the spectrum?
Of what?
So, of being okay.
Okay.
Legally, and then obviously, and then the way it played out is different than whether it's legal.
Yeah, so obviously, again, safe answers case by case, and the council would be giving you or delegating to you, presumably, implied authority to make those types of decisions if you felt it was absolutely, you know, necessary, warranted. What I would do in that case is probably something similar to you. The risk to that type of action, though, is notwithstanding that they're not hitting reply all, because you were concerned about the public meetings aspect, clearly, by hitting a reply all that's effectively a meeting that would violate the public meetings, but still arguably you're having a vote. You're soliciting a vote or support from your council. And so it still perhaps frustrates the public meeting law aspects because although you're not getting a reply all, you're asking for some support. And a response to a question that otherwise would be presented to the council as a whole in a formal public meeting. However, what I would probably suggest you do in the future would be to send it off, tell the council that you believe that it's appropriate for you or the city to support this particular activity, and then, you know, don't necessarily ask for their input. I would suggest that if they have any significant reservations, to contact you individually, but not a yay or a nay to the action. And I know I'm splitting hairs here, folks, but unfortunately, you got to. It's not a yay or nay. It's, do you have significant concerns? If you do, let me know immediately. Otherwise, you're going to sign the letter, and then you bring it back to the council for ratification.
Through a motion.
That's the way you do it.
I have. But then, aren't you setting... What I'm worried about is setting precedents.
I am too, and that's the slippery slope. That's what I led off with. They've got to put, you've got to put trust in Corey that it's not going to create some type of understanding that he has the ability to do that all the time. If it's an absolute emergency and have to do it, and it's not going to cause any fiscal impact to the city, not otherwise going to put the city in a political, you know, politically sensitive position. If the council is comfortable with it, then you could more or less acquiesce and allow him to do it. And by reaching out, by Corey reaching out and asking for concerns, in my mind, if you had concern about it still, you could fire an email back or pick up the phone and say, hey, look, although generally it's okay, here are my concerns. And then Corey at that time can exercise his judgment as to whether or not he should wait.
Okay, I think that's what I did in my email.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I wasn't comfortable with it going that way.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, the folks, the reality is you're a public institution. If this was a private institution, these issues would be resolved like that. But you're held to a different set of standards. You're held to a standard where your actions have to be taken in the public domain. And so it slows things down. As a consequence of these procedural difficulties, hurdles, if you will, we're not going to be as responsive and you're going to run into issues like that.
Yeah, so ultimately what that puts me in the position of doing is saying, and maybe it's best if we have a formal policy on this, is if you don't give us at least a month or more to provide a letter of support, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
It would have been easy for me to tell the grant writer, too short a notice, not going to happen.
And you know what, that's a very safe response as well. And there are city managers that effectively have adopted that policy. I'm sorry, you know, the response is, I'm sorry, if it was really this important to you, I should have had it 2 weeks ago, four weeks ago, and then had it gone through the proper process. However, again, to draw a black and white line right there and say, we will never do it, I think that's unreasonable as well. So you've got to be careful.
So what if you had, say like this, he sent out the email, and one counselor was dead against it? Should put everything on hold?
Well, that's up to Corey. Because if Corey goes and signs it anyway, Corey might not have the best of relationships with that particular
officer. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it may create other issues. Now, if I'm Corey, unless I really believe that I need to sign it, notwithstanding that one objection, I'm not going to sign it.
Right.
It's not worth it to me. Particularly when, again, as we suggested, they could have presented the letter of support weeks ago, months ago. If it's a grant, those grant writers are drafting or writing those documents for months, usually, leading up to the submission. And so they literally, for lack of a better expression, have placed their problem on Corey, or on the city.
If anything, what this scenario highlights is what I heard a city manager say at the League of Oregon Cities conference 6 months ago, or maybe it was the previous year. There's this much black and this much white in city management, or even functioning in a city, and this much gray.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
Can we touch maybe a little bit on mayor, council president roles?
Okay.
Just, I mean, we touched on city manager, council, but also mayor and council president and what?
Sure. Do you have your charter?
Handy? I can grab a copy.
If you don't mind, that'd be great.
Sure.
Your charter basically specifies these various positions. You know, the council, well, let's just go through it.
Thank you.
Do you have a copy of this?
No, this is what I want.
I got mine too.
I just got up and grabbed it. I wasn't trying to buy it.
Council rules, is it developed in the council?
Well, I thought there were copies.
Or is it developed in the council?
No.
It should be developed in the
one. I was stealing it from you, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it discusses the presiding officer. Yeah, here's presiding officer section. Okay.
Extra what?
Oh, I just considered an extra copy of the council rules.
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't print.
No, that's fine. Let's just go through it now. So, your charter obviously establishes the mayor and the councilors. Within the council rules, however, it establishes a presiding officer, a president, if you will, and then the mayor. And so the president basically serves, was appointed at the outset of the year in January. And the president's role generally is to serve in the capacity of the mayor when the mayor is absent, not available to be present during that particular council meeting, work session, executive session, what have you. In my mind, let's say by way of example, if you had a resolution that was presented to the council for approval, the mayor was absent, the resolution was passed by the council, it would be the council president then that would sign that resolution in lieu of or on behalf of the mayor. But there is no legal vesting, so to speak, in the president of the council beyond serving as what people call a pro tem mayor while the mayor is absent. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Do we have anybody that's the president for the mayor?
Stu.
Oh, Stu. Okay.
Can we, are you ready for another question?
Always.
Can we go back to the proposed contracts that are sent out for council review?
You bet.
We recently had three contracts submitted to us by email.
Okay.
I don't know what anybody else did, but I printed mine out because I have a better analysis by looking at them. I compared them. I then went to their individual websites, looked there, mm-hmm. and I made my determination, and according to the email we got, we were supposed to individually get back to our city manager and tell them what our the results of our review was. So I did these things, and I went back to Corey, and my opinion is that instead of doing it by email, it should have been done at either a council work session or a council meeting, because other councilors probably had or could have had a different review, and some of their opinions might have affected how I felt. And by the same token, the review that I made might have made a difference in their opinion of how that contract or which contract should have been signed. So basically, I'm not trying to put the burden on Corey, but I know that the contract was signed afterwards, and I'm not going back trying to rehash anything. I just think that in the future, what's your opinion? Should it be done by email, or should it be done in a council meeting?
I got to ask a clarifying question real
sure.
quick. Is this the signed proposals, the landscape architect services? Nothing's been signed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it'll be on the work session next week. And what I did was send out the proposals, but we haven't formalized a contract. We haven't put anything in contractual language yet.
I think you're getting it confused with the First Street landscaping and the landscaping sign.
The landscaping one, yes. That's
yeah,
the one
they're
I'm
two separate
about.
Ones. He's getting it confused with First Street that we yeah. accepted the proposal last meeting.
You mean the bid mm-hmm. process?
Yeah, the three bids that you sent out.
No, that's the sign proposal. I sent out.
I know he's getting
okay,
those
yeah.
two confused.
Okay. So the sign proposals were three different proposals from landscape architecture companies that I solicited. Actually over the last 6 months or more than that, and they've been sitting sort of on the back burner for a while. And so in preparation of bringing it back to the work session, it's on the agenda for next week, I sent out the proposals in advance of the packet going out, usually less than a week prior to the meeting, so that everyone could look at it and become familiarized with what the project is, who had submitted proposals, and then we will discuss it at the work session. And then from there, we'll work on putting together a formal contract. I haven't, yeah, so.
Okay, I misunderstood.
That's okay.
I thought it had already been signed.
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay, can we go back?
Yeah.
I want to know the mayor's roles. Am I doing something wrong or what? Come on.
So, again, the mayor's roles actually developed in 5.1 of your rules. Obviously elected at the general election for a term of 2 years. Recognized as the head of the city for ceremonial purposes. Here's the way I look at it, just to cut right to the chase. You're going to run the meetings. You're going to be in charge of making sure that the meetings are being conducted in an effective and efficient manner. You usually are delegated as being the spokesperson on behalf of the council. You're signing ordinances. You're signing resolutions. You're more or less the figurehead, so to speak, of the body as a whole. Do you have specific questions as far as
well,
the role?
Yeah, I have been trying to, you know, get the councilors more involved. There's no 2-minute rule,
sure.
3-minute rule.
Sure.
Talk for 10 minutes if it's on the same subject. But I've been going like around the table so everybody gets a chance to speak. And then if you think of something later, we'll go around the table again.
Sure.
You know, work sessions are different than...
There's great latitude given to you as far as how you go about conducting your meetings. If you believe that that's the most effective and efficient way to hold or conduct a meeting, that's up to you and the council. If the council collectively ultimately says, well, we don't like this 2-minute limitation, or we don't like being, you know, offering 10 minutes to each councilor to speak, we want it to be run more effective or efficient, then obviously they'll let you know that. But in my mind, you're responsible for ensuring that the meetings are conducted in a very efficient manner. And what you determine is efficient is, again, there's great latitude given to you to make that determination.
Okay, and then like on the agenda sometimes we don't have public comments, but when we come by an issue or something, I go off the edge and ask if the public...
Oh, you're talking about during an agenda item, letting the public speak
comment,
not during public comments.
Yes, yeah, so your rules, I thought, spelled out how public comments are to be dealt with. Am I wrong? Should I learn it?
Somewhat.
It just ended at the beginning and the end of the meeting.
Right. Yeah.
That's all it says.
Let me just look here before I speak.
There are some circumstances where statute might provide that you're going to need to provide, like a public hearing, where you need to provide.
Not that scenario.
Not right.
just a general
this
agenda
general.
Item.
Okay.
That would be up to your discretion, wouldn't it?
I'm curious to see. I want to see what the rules say. Some cities, they'll set it up where if you have comments on an agenda item, so the public can see the agenda item, then they'll offer opportunity there. Otherwise, you sign up and you speak at the beginning or you speak at the end. But that's also, I think they still specify that in the rules, or if they don't specify in the rules, it's up to the mayor to set that up.
We tried that with our last mayor and he didn't follow it.
So essentially, you are identifying, based upon your rules, you've got within your agenda a specific item that's been identified or time for public to comment on the agenda as a whole. And then your question is, do you have then the prerogative to solicit public input on individual agenda items in addition to the general public comment item?
Basically.
And so to parallel or dovetail on Alan's comment, to some extent, depending on the issue, it's already implied or provided that public comment would be solicited. For example, when you adopt an ordinance, presumably you're soliciting public comment on the ordinance before it's adopted. In addition to that, I have no objection with the mayor soliciting public comments on individual agenda items. The only dilemma or problem that I see with that is if you don't control how that public comment is entertained, so to speak, you could be dealing with one agenda item for hours upon hours. It's an exaggeration, but you could ultimately run into an issue of efficiency.
Well, yeah.
And just to state the obvious.
I mean, that's that gray area, I guess, we're talking
about. You're going to have to exercise your judgment. The only concern that I would have as well would be you do open a Pandora's box, because then on if the public has a perception or believes that there is basically a policy established that the council is going to allow you to speak to each individual agenda item, and then on one occasion you shut them off or you otherwise go a different direction, you're going to at a minimum have some very frustrated citizens. And there are certain agenda items that you might not want a whole bunch of dialogue on, and I can think of many that's come from this city that you might not want a bunch of dialogue on. And I'm not trying to stymie the public. That's not my objective. But understand that the public meetings laws do not guarantee the public the right to speak. It gives them the right to participate via physically being present, but not speak. Because if you allowed on certain agenda items, I mean, think of the marijuana issues that we've dealt with over the years. If we allowed every single individual citizen to speak on that issue, we would have been here for hours upon hours. Am I answering the question? More or less?
I think, forget it.
Freaking black and white on that one.
Okay, there is no, oh no, you're not, first of all, we're lawyers. You're never going to get black and white.
In general, Jeremy, would it be fair to say that being more inclusive and open to public comment is better than being closed and shutting down public
Absolutely,
comment?
Because yeah. Without question. I'd rather you err on the side of being more inclusive than not.
Well, if it's a marijuana issue, you know I'd never bring that up. Forget that. But this was the habitat thing, remember?
Oh, sure.
An encouraged group, you know, when you've got a hot topic, so to speak, a politically sensitive issue, encourage folks to identify one spokesperson to speak on behalf of the group. That's something you could initiate at the outset of the agenda item and request that rather than have the same comments made time and time and time again. Have these groups identify a spokesperson, and they can speak to the issue once. Okay. That's within your prerogative as well.
That helped. Thanks.
So moving to public meetings. So slide number one. There we go. So we're going to cover general public meeting requirements, executive sessions, and enforcement and consequences. So we've somewhat alluded to this already. Oregon's public meetings laws ensures essentially that governing bodies are going to take action, deliberate and discuss matters in open meetings, and there are exceptions to that. These public meeting laws basically prohibit a quorum of a governing body from meeting in private, and we're going to talk about email communications and telephone communications here shortly. But it prohibits you from meeting as a quorum in private for purposes of deciding or deliberating on city business. And again, I throw that qualification city business because there is nothing, despite what some folks believe, there is nothing under Oregon law that says you all can't get together for a big Oregon duck party come here this fall, right?
I'd be against that.
So that's permissive. It's when you all get together and talk about city business that becomes a problem. The law imposes certain notice and accessibility requirements. And then, as I have already stated, the laws guarantee the public a right to view, not participate, but view government meetings. Alan, I'm going to turn this
to you. Yes, so the three big definitions that will... that we're throwing around here. Public body, first of all, which you can think of broadly, is any governmental entity that you're going to think of. So counties, cities, special districts, state agencies, they fall within the definition of a public body. The governing body is two or more members of that public body that have that authority to make a decision, essentially to act on behalf of the public body. And finally, the meeting, which is what we're going to focus on here, and that's the convening of a public meeting is the convening of the governing body for which quorum is required to make or deliberate toward a decision. And those are the keys that the when we get into when you're violating public meeting laws, it's that making or deliberating towards a decision on any matter that might come before the city.
Let's pause real quick on public bodies. So your committees and commissions, to the extent that they're serving in an advisory capacity, I'm going to oversimplify things here, but if you were to set up, for example, an arts committee, an airport committee, not that you have an airport yet, but maybe someday you will.
Or public works committee.
Public works committee. Any committee that is established by the council, planning commission is obvious, so I didn't identify you specifically, but a committee that is established by the council that reports or advises the council or even the planning commission for that matter would constitute a public body for purposes of the public meeting laws, which means that the laws and the regs that apply to the council and the planning commission also apply to the committees for purposes of notice, accessibility, decisions, and so on.
So you're saying I can invite the public works over to have a picnic at my house. They can come over, but we can't talk about city business.
If you bring that committee over and they begin to dialogue on city business, you've got a public meeting.
So basically that's another black and white one. Don't do it.
Yeah, it's a black and white one for me, you bet.
Yeah, as soon as you have a quorum of you all together, that's where you start getting into the risks of offending the public.
Now, I think the way it's like you have a quorum or a governing body is two members. A quorum is three.
I'm sorry. So the law prohibits quorum. Those were the definitions for the law, and they were taken out of law. So what you need to avoid is where a quorum of the governing body is getting together for the purpose of meeting delivery towards something. And
but if you have two people who just say, by the way, what do you think, John? That is not a public meeting that
depends.
You don't have to.
It depends, because what if you had a committee of three?
And we have a committee of five.
For you all, yes. The Planning Commission, that's different.
If you have a quorum, that means more than half of the body.
Correct. Well,
so if we had three people in the thing, then it would be a quorum of two. But I need
two vacancies,
right?
Sure.
Yes. If you had those vacancies.
Well, we've already gone through that.
Okay. Just to make sure that I'm going to repeat it back to you to make sure I understand your question. If you had a committee of three and you had two, you would have the quorum.
You would have a quorum.
Correct.
If you had a committee of five and you had two, that is not quorum, that is not governing body, that is people discussing something.
Correct. However, now here's the curveball. If you just had the two, and those two then subsequently dialogue with one or dialogue with two others, and we're going to get into handy here soon, it's plausible that that might frustrate the public meeting laws because you're playing the telephone game.
Just don't do it.
Oh. Just don't do it.
That was my question.
And we're going to get into that. The handy situation is entirely problematic, but we'll get into that slide shortly. So underlying policy, help citizens understand government decisions, the underlying policy of public meeting laws, help build trust in government, provide access to the process of deliberation, enable the public to view government at work and influence deliberations, and then to gain credibility. Serial meetings, you want to start with this one?
So perfect timing there, because this is exactly what this case was involved serial meetings which are one-on-one meetings or communications among a form of a governing body, either directly or indirectly, maybe through an intermediary, and in this case, it happened to be the county administrator. Before we jump into this, this is a very, very hot topic right now. We had a recent Supreme Court case on this, and it is a constant discussion among city attorneys. So, as a little background for this case, when we say the one-on-one conversations, the one-on-one meetings or serial meetings, the good example there would have been if the two of you met together and the purpose of the meeting, you talked about city or about some city business and you reached a decision, and then after that meeting you went to the third, even though he wasn't involved, and you same discussion, and then all three of you are in agreement. Under this case law, you're probably in violation of public meeting laws. So a little background to the handy case. because it helps contextualize what was going on. The plaintiff in the Haney case, the person that brought the claim, was actually a former county commissioner. And at the time, he was in campaigning for re-election. He was out seeking, he was soliciting campaign funds, and he went to one of his neighbors and solicited funds to pay a debt that he actually owed the county, resulting from an earlier public meeting law violation. That was another case. So after the resident received this solicitation, he contacts the district attorney because the resident was concerned, sends and lets him know what's going on, and then the county council begins investigating and contacts the DOJ. So the following day, the resident's attorney sends the plaintiff, sends that county commissioner a letter, and also CCs the county council, alleging these violations of the meetings law and alleging violations of campaign finance. Around that time, or shortly thereafter, the local reporters get wind of this, and they make these public records requests of the county, seeking copies of that letter. The next thing that happens is the county council forwards the letter to the county administrator, as well as three members of the five-member commission. So then, that's where the communications, that's where we start getting into what happens there is what leads to the case. So the communications in general, just so you know, it wasn't some, when you read the case and you read the transcripts, it wasn't this background trying to circumvent the laws. They were trying to decide what to do with these public records requests. They were trying to figure it out. And the first communication was from the county administrator to the two commissioners, and they each reply. They each reply what they want to do. And if you go to the next sentence, after the county administrator gets these communications, he emails to the whole, once he gets the information back from the two commissioners, he forwards it on to the entire county, or to the county council, and the email states, here's the communications about calling an emergency session and the reason why. I called Commissioner Stewart, who was a third commissioner, to get his input, and we then scheduled it. So at that point, the county administrator had conferred with two commissioners, and finally a third one, and they decided that they were A, gonna have this executive session, and P, and the subject there was whether or not they were gonna release this opinion. County council eventually informs the administrator that he's not gonna release the attorney's letter, and at that point, the county administrator calls this emergency session, they vote to release the letter. So after they vote to release the letter, the plaintiff sues the county and the three commissioners individually for violating the public meetings law. And the second claim of relief there is pertinent here is that the county commissioners violated the Oregon law by conducting private meetings to deliberate or decide upon matters of public business. Keep in mind, it was whether or not to have this executive session and whether, or I'm sorry, an emergency meeting, and whether or not to release the record. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals, when this went to the Court of Appeals ruled yes. They said yes. You know, what happened between the county administrator and the commissioners, these conversations you guys were having, that violates the public meeting laws. You guys are going, you're deliberating towards city business, and you're doing it without the proper notice, without the proper procedures, and therefore it's in violation. It went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court disagreed, but it disagreed in such a way that it was a very nuanced disagreement. It was a procedural disagreement. It wasn't necessarily on the whole facts of the case. And because of that, we still recommend that you avoid these serial communications. You avoid them. It's still kind of a gray area as far as the Supreme Court goes, but my advice would be to follow what the Court of Appeals said and to avoid them.
And it seems logical if you consider, again, the premise of the public meeting laws, which is provide access to the process of deliberation, enable the public to view government at work and influence deliberations and to gain credibility. If you think about that very premise, serial meetings are clearly inconsistent with those premises. So
it's kind of ironic that they were trying to schedule a public meeting, though.
Yeah.
Executive session's different, but anyways, that's beside the point.
I was going to say, I think a little context there is I think that the plaintiff there, the former county commissioner, was kind of smarting over what had happened. You know, $20,000 debt to the county because he had previously done, there were the same kind of communications. He'd been going office to office to office of the commissioners and getting these votes. And so I think they were highly aware of what was going on, and it was, you know, it is, like you said, you know, as a point of, they weren't trying to backdoor anything. They were trying to decide, what should we do with this? And it was all very quick, you know, it was a matter of days that they called it and made the decision. So.
No, that's good context to keep in mind. If the county administrator had reached out individually to three of the commissioners, one-on-one, the county administrator, and gotten direction to schedule an executive meeting,
that likely would have been okay, one-on-one.
Perfect.
No, okay. No communication with
just making sure. Yeah, that's how you, because the county administrator is not an elected member of the commission.
Correct.
Okay. But the flip side of that, if it would have been like the mayor calling individually, then that would consist of it.
I would argue a serial meeting.
Serial meeting. So
lessons from Handy. Private computer email accounts communications could be subject to a public records request or litigation disclosure. That's something to keep in mind. I assume you each have your own city email address. So I would stress the importance of only using that email for city business.
Just the council.
I was going to say, yeah.
So use it only for city business. Do not use your personal business by virtue of that city email account. Know that your communications via email when talking about city business is likely subject to disclosure, both public records disclosures and, again, litigation. And then the liability issue. Your knowledge of the public meeting requirements now puts you in a position where if you knowingly and willfully engage in a violation of the public meeting laws, you may have individual liability exposure, meaning the city will not be there to write the check. You will have to write that check. And in addition to public meeting law violations, it could be an ethical violation as well. And so, you know, the payment of fines and fees for those types of violations come from your personal bank accounts. Any questions on that before we move on?
How long are the emails forever?
It's a great question. They should be archived by the city because they're this public, you know, public records. And then Corey presumably has his own schedule as far as archiving is concerned, a schedule during which he will trash them, so to speak, or get rid of them after a period of time. But so yeah, you keep them and you let Corey make the decision as to when they need to be thrown away or discarded.
Okay, because you know we've got a couple councilors and a mayor. You know, where are those emails sitting?
Where are the emails sitting?
Yeah, are they still?
They're on our server.
Okay.
So yeah, still have them all. Still.
Yeah, as long as he can access them, they don't have to be in hard copy, so to speak. They can be in cyberspace as long as they're accessible. You're fine.
And then you're on a schedule.
Well, everything at this point, everything is on. We host. So, and this is a separate question, but kind of connected to this. We host our email on our server that's upstairs right now, and it's backed up. So everything's on there. We haven't gotten rid of anything.
Good.
You know. We've only had our city emails for, I don't know, less than 10 years, right? So at some point,
so it's still
down
there.
The road, yeah, it's still there.
Okay.
Now, I've got a quick question. If, and I know a lot of other public entities probably do this, we'll be talking about next week, possibly moving our email to be hosting at an offsite server. Does that open up anything weird from a legal perspective? I don't think so.
As long as the offsite server has sufficient safeguards in place.
It does.
So you're likely fine.
That's right.
Yeah.
So right now, some of us have our private email plus a city email, and when the city sends stuff out, they send it to everything.
Well, let's change that. Let's change it so it only goes to your city email. Absolutely.
Okay.
And then another suggestion, Corey, and this is your purview, not mine, but you may want to get the planning commissioners their own city emails.
I was just thinking about that.
I'd rather them not use their personal emails on business.
My question is, how far does that go? I guess it would just be any governing body, so the public works committee is going to need them too.
Public works would adapt to it too.
Planning commission, without question, no hesitation. The city council.
Lower hanging.
You know, you start when you get lower and lower down the road. Your budget committee.
I was going to say.
Definitely. Well,
they meet once a year.
Well, yeah, but your budget chair, for example, they're going to want one presumably. But you've got to exercise independent judgment and discretion on it. I just know that when it comes to my planning commission, without question, they're on city emails. Your city council should be, city staff obviously. Yeah. What other commissions or committees do you have?
I love it, urban renewal, sorry Gordon.
Urban renewal should have their own
absolutely.
City.
Absolutely, have their own agency.
Okay. Who else do you have?
Public Works Committee would be the last one. Would they meet every other month generally?
Up to you.
Yeah.
Up to you.
Okay.
So as independent contractors, how would you deal with emails with that? Now, like, you know, you're hired by the city to represent. I'm hired.
You're Edco employee.
An Edco employee.
So. Not a
yeah, that's different.
Okay.
Yeah, so Edco email.
Although, like, Tim.
And as an independent contractor, because they have an agreement, a contract, what does that do?
Yeah, by way of what?
Like,
so our planning consultant, or you guys don't have a city email. You're an independent contractor.
It's different. We're talking about internal committees versus independent contractors. Independent contractors will have their own email addresses.
Yeah, I can't totally have our own.
You bet.
Would I use the same one I had as a counselor? It would be a separate.
No, planning commission email.
Okay. Well, it would still be kagan@ci.la-us.
We're not going to donate.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Oh.
It's fine.
Okay.
Does that make sense, though? I mean, I think logically, it's a no-brainer. As long as you feed from a... How do you put logistical standpoint can do it? You guys have the capability to do that, Corey?
We've got the capacity to have everyone have an email address. The issue more so is the platform with which folks can access the email remotely.
Yeah.
That's not the most user-friendly platform. So that's the other side of the coin, which has nothing to do with the legal side.
Yeah, I'll let you handle that, big guy. That's not me.
Okay.
The other thing that's come up, and I'm definitely not advocating anything here, but some cities have gone so far as to provide their counselors iPads and computers so that they're not using their personal computers for public emails and public documents. And again, the reason for that is if I'm suing the city, and I know that you all have been communicating on the pending issue, and I want to subpoena your records, and I don't think you're giving me all your records, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to file a subpoena with the court to obtain your laptops, and your laptop's gone. The court's going to award that subpoena, and that means I'm taking possession of your laptop. So whatever's on your laptop, it might be incidentally disclosed to my opposing counsel, myself, my client, and frankly the judge. So keep that in mind as well. And that's an issue of economics. You may not have the economics to provide your counselors their own resources, you know, computers or laptops, but something to consider. Yeah. Matt just recently acquired iPads for, I guess it had been a year or two ago, through some type of program. And so all the counselors have these iPads that have keyboards on them, and that's what they use.
A lot of cities are moving that way. They're actually getting rid of their paper agendas, doing it all digital.
Makes sense. And then you all can download the agenda and the packet right, you know, right at the podium here on your iPads and go right through it. It's pretty cool. So another little tidbit. Sorry, I just probably cost the city $20.
Yes, you did. Thank you. But that's okay.
Executive sessions is what we're going to move to next. So executive sessions are the exception to the public meeting law, or I shouldn't say laws, but the requirement that deliberations be held in an open meeting. Under certain limited statutory exceptions, a city council can go into executive session to discuss such things as staff discipline, litigation, purchasing real property, attorney-client privilege communications. Some of you obviously have been here where I've been in executive session with you to talk about pending litigation, real estate issues, staff discipline, so on and so forth. What's important, well actually let's talk briefly about excluding. Basically you can exclude members of the public from those executive sessions. You can exclude virtually everyone except for the press. The press is still permitted to be there, unless the press is the subject of the pending litigation or the issue at hand, which has happened before. The press, although there isn't a law that requires this, the press is generally directed not to report on what is discussed in executive session other than the general subject matter. And again, contrary to popular belief, the law does not prohibit them from reporting on what's discussed in the executive session. It is assumed that as a professional courtesy, they will not. And then again, executive sessions is not an opportunity to protect the public from unpleasantness. It's an opportunity to put you generally as a council, as a body, on an equal playing field with, for example, private bodies or private institutions, particularly when addressing pending litigation. You want to cover this one?
Just a few to touch on what Jeremy just said, a few of the examples where you might go into executive session. I think there's 14 or 15 actually in the statute, but consider employment of a public officer, consider the dismissal or discipline of a public officer, an employee or a staff member. Real estate, talking about real estate transactions with a person designated to negotiate such transactions, and consult with your counsel concerning litigation filed or likely to be filed against the city. And then finally, one of them, the last two are ones that we often come across, and the final one is to consider records that are exempt by law from public disclosure, which often, when we're involved, will be an attorney-client privilege memorandum. Sure, so the next four or five items will be some of the issues that come out of executive session, some of the mistakes. And the first one up there is one that's not so much something that council's gonna make, but it still needs to be known that the deficient notice and announcement. So the law requires notice, and the notice must contain the reason in the statutory citation for the reason that you're entering into executive session. The announcement portion is that at the commencement or during open session before entering into executive session, there must be an announcement that the body will be going into exec session. The one that's a little less likely to occur due to any counselor is the deficient minutes. There need to be minutes under the law, but they don't need to be disclosed to the public. One that comes up quite a bit is when you get off topic. So going up to the notice, you'll provide a statement about the reason and the statutory citation for why you're going to go into exec session. Once you get into the exec session, you need to keep your discussion, keep it focused on the reason that you went into it. So you can have that discussion, and you can talk about multiple bases for going into exec session, so long as you notice that at the commencement. So where we have it, or where we might see it, is if you go in on to discuss an attorney-client privilege memorandum and you're discussing it, and then some other topic that's on the agenda comes up. It's not under the meetings laws, under the laws, it's not appropriate to have that discussion then. I think if you go to the next slide, there it is. So, even if you could have had that discussion, even if it was a permissible topic to talk about in exec session and you didn't notice it, it's not okay to discuss it during that session. So anytime you want to go into it, you need to make sure to cover what you're going to cover and put that in the notice and put the citation in there so that you can have that conversation in executive session, because it's not all right to discuss that attorney-client privilege memorandum that you were going to discuss under the notice and then also talk about a real estate negotiation, even if you could have, if it wasn't noticed. We talked about in your council rules discuss not disclosing confidential information or communications between the attorney. Another place where this comes up is disclosing confidential information that was discussed at executive session. We ask you to keep that amongst yourselves. It's meant for executive session and not to go outside of executive session, discuss it with any members of the public. And the reason there is, we don't want to lose some of the privileges that we'd otherwise rely on for getting in there, and there could be confidential information that it's really important that we keep it confidential, and once it's disclosed, we could lose the basis to keep it confidential further down the road. Executive session is not the venue to make a decision. You need to remember you can discuss, you can deliberate. You need to go back into open session to make a decision on anything that was discussed. And finally, when you intend to come back into exec session or from exec session back to an open session, it's good practice to mention at the beginning of the announcement that you will return to open session at the end of executive session, and the law requires that you do that prior to going into exec session. The Ethics Commission has the jurisdiction over these violations, and as we've kind of discussed and as you've seen in the slides, that some of the a violation of the public meetings law, public records law, public meetings law and exec session, or executive session laws, the responsibility will come on the individual and not necessarily the city.
Okay,
Okay, how many people, how does an executive session come about?
meaning what? How do you initiate one?
Yeah.
Your council rules actually, I believe it spells it out, No, it doesn't?
I don't know.
That's your charger.
Ultimately, how I see it playing out is, depending on the nature of the topic, I would be consulting with Jeremy and or Alan. They would be advising me, and then we would set up all of this prior notice and the entire template appropriately.
That's usually how it is initiated. Your rules expand upon that. It says the executive sessions will be called by the presiding officer by the request of a majority of the council, the city manager, or the city attorney. A motion or notice calling for an executive session will identify the specific, well, it just gets into the legalities from there. But yeah, 9 times out of 10, what happens is court picks up the phone and says, here's our issue. Do we have the statutory authority to go into executive session? And if so, what is that authority and how would you suggest we proceed? Every once in a blue moon, particularly in a smaller municipality like this, you get one or two counselors that are interested in an executive session. My suggestion would be that you all route it to the city manager and allow the city manager to work with us to get it scheduled if it's appropriate. Enforcement, so how do you enforce a violation of the executive session statutes or public meetings laws for that matter? It's legal action, commencement of a legal action. What's important to note that is if someone challenges an executive session or a public meetings violations and they prevail, it is possible for them to collect attorney fees as well. So not only could you potentially be exposed to the violation of the fines and ultimately a damage recovery by the plaintiff, but you could also be responsible for the plaintiff's attorney fees as well. Which we all know, attorneys like to run up those fees. And then, of course, the negative perception.
$5, $10.
They become adopted.
Ethics is next. Are we going quick enough? I hope we're not boring you all. No? We're okay? All right, so ethics. We don't really care about ethics, right? I mean, we're done. Yeah, that's right. So we're going to address conflicts of interest and then use of the official office to obtain financial gain. And this is actually a good one for both the PC, the Planning Commission, and the City Council. These rules apply to both of you. So Oregon law recognizes that conflicts of interest are inevitable, particularly in a smaller municipality like mine. A public official is required to refrain from taking any official action on matters that would result in a financial gain or detriment to the official, a relative of the official, or to a business with which the official and or relative is associated. So, again, this is a commonly misunderstood legal concept as to what constitutes a conflict of interest. Conflicts of interest, for all practical purposes, are financial driven. And so, with that being said, we'll first start with what constitutes a relative. There's the description or definition of relative. It's quite extended. It includes the spouse, parent, step-parent, child sibling, step-sibling, and so on. I mean, it's extensive.
And it keeps going.
Yes. And I would address that second bullet there. Any individual from whom the candidate receives benefits arising from that individual's employment, so it extends to someone that you might have an employee-employer relationship with as well. Business, again, relatively expansive. Business with which the person is associated means a private business or closely held corp of which the person, meaning the subject individual, or the person's relative is a director, officer, owner, or employer agent, and any private business or closely held corp in which the person or the person's relative owns or has owned stock. And we're looking at a minimum of about $1,000 or more in any of the preceding calendar year. Alan, expand on these if you see a need to.
Yeah, I
don't. Again, continues any public held corporation, except the difference between the private and the public is the monetary threshold. For a public corporation, it's increased to $100,000. And then for a publicly held corporation, it's a little bit more limited in the sense that it's specific to a director or officer within the public corporation. So now we'll talk about conflicts of interest, the differences between a potential versus an actual conflict. And it's important because how you must respond or what your disclosure requirements are differ depending upon whether it's a potential conflict or an actual conflict. So a potential conflict arises when the public official takes official action that could financially benefit the public official. So it's a possibility. Whereas an actual conflict of interest arises when there is, well, it's not a possibility. It will financially benefit the public official. Let me give you a classic example. If one of you owned a snow removal business and you were on the city council and the council was awarding a snow removal contract to your snow removal business, I think it's safe to say you've got an actual conflict of interest.
In the next slide, we'll just discuss a couple and just to tag on to that. Some of the common situations where we see the conflicts of interest come up, and first one's the approval of bills, the receipts in the consent agenda. This often happens if you own a business in town and it's got a receipt in the consent agenda. That's a situation where you'll have a conflict of interest. Like Jeremy said, the award of a public contract, you all are the local contract review boards, so you will at times be faced with contracts that you or a relative might be the recipient of that contract. That's another situation where a conflict of interest, and then also approval of land use permits, depending on who the applicant might be.
So the requirements, if you're faced with a conflict of interest, as I noted, your response differs depending upon what type of conflict you have. If it's a potential, you need only disclose the potential conflict of interest during the meeting. What I'd suggest is if it was, for example, well, snow removal would not be a good example, but if there was a possibility that it would financially benefit you, before deliberations, before there's any discussion on the issue, ask the mayor for permission to speak and disclose a potential conflict. Provide full disclosure of that potential conflict. Get it in the minutes. Once that is done, you can not only discuss and deliberate on the issue, but you can also be part of the decision-making process, meaning you can vote yay or nay on that particular issue. If, in contrast, it's an actual conflict of interest, again, you must identify that actual conflict of interest at the outset of the discussion, immediately after getting permission to speak, and you may not vote or participate in deliberations.
So, Jeremy, mine?
Yes. Yes, so yours is a great example. In fact, I remember yours coming up.
A couple times.
Yeah, so in my opinion, if, for example, your invoices, your company invoices are in the consent agenda, are they in the consent agenda?
We recently changed our consent agenda so that the council does not approve all bills.
Okay.
Because we've got multiple layers to the review process for issuing checks. So we took that out because every consent agenda, Stu was reading the release. I acknowledge, you know, consent. I recuse myself from discussion and voting on the consent agenda, so we
okay.
Had an alternative route.
So on yours, you would disclose the conflict when it comes up and just abstain from participating and voting on it. Pretty simple.
You are just a potential conflict.
No, you're an actual conflict.
I am an actual.
Oh, you're an actual.
Well, it comes up with me too, so.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively. Right, Stu?
Yeah.
Especially Civil War.
You're going to run into Mr. Property.
Yeah, yours would be even more so, wouldn't it? Or it could be.
No, mine only comes up when there are bills to approve because I don't have anything in directly in relationship to awarding contracts that,
okay.
I mean, they could be awarded to a customer of mine, but it's not, I don't know, how would that work?
A customer of yours? Well, give me the background.
So I own a plan center for contractors.
Okay.
So it's a membership-based organization, and I provide information of bids that are out.
Okay.
In any type, public, private, commercial. But I also post for public entities the bidding documents on my website so that there's a common place where the public can access
sure.
those. So the
sure.
city pays me for that. City Sisters does, City Bend does, multiple mm-hmm. public agencies pay me for that. But it didn't dawn on me until you asked that I have customers that could potentially be awarded even the landscape bid that was just out for the city. But it's not, I mean, because my fee structure is...
Is there a direct financial benefit to you associated?
If they are awarded it?
Yes.
No.
Then at a minimum, or at the most, perhaps you have a potential conflict, and you could always, just to be safe, identify that you may have a potential conflict of interest. But if you're not going to receive any type of financial benefit, then you don't even have a potential. If you don't feasibly or reasonably believe that you may receive a financial benefit, you don't even have a potential conflict.
Okay.
Does that make sense? But when in doubt, I'm all about disclosing.
Because it's a membership-based organization, whether they get a job or not, doesn't affect
you. That makes it a lot easier for you, in my opinion.
Okay.
Any? Did you have a question?
I have a question. Since Dennis is the mayor, he gets asked to serve sometimes on committees and that might come to the council. And we've questioned whether that's a conflict, because that does happen. And I get asked to serve on things. That's not a problem, right?
Yeah, well, if it's an interesting issue, because if you would, are you two
married?
Okay, just want to make sure. I made the assumption, but I wanted to confirm on. So theoretically, a financial benefit to you is also a financial benefit to him. But in short, when it comes to these committees or these organizations, if you two are not going to receive a financial benefit as a consequence of the decision, there's no conflict.
Okay.
However, I still suggest, again, that you identify that you're affiliated with the organization, the committee. Why not? Why not go above and beyond? This is for all of you. Mm-hmm. And simply throw it on the table so that someone can't question your integrity. It's all about full disclosure.
Disclosing it doesn't prevent me from voting on it or anything. It just says that the potential exists.
Even if you have and again, it's not even technically a conflict. I'm using common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, the conflict, the ethic clause, are driven by financial benefits. The fact is, even if you're not receiving a financial benefit, if you're associated with a particular organization, let's say, by way of example, Newberry Habitat for Humanity. If one of you were on that board, and is someone on the board for Newberry?
Not anymore.
But if one of you were reviewing and evaluating a decision that might benefit Newberry, clearly it's not going to benefit you individually by supporting that particular action or activity, but you're affiliated with the organization, so why not disclose it?
And that's really what I'm saying. There's no financial benefit,
right,
but you're associated.
That's right.
Okay.
So disclose it, be above board.
And don't tell any more Girl Scout cookies. I don't want to be on anything.
I think the Supreme Court ruled on Girl Scout cookies, so they're exempt, right?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot, that's good. You want to go through this?
Just a quick example of conflict of interest where it came up in another Oregon jurisdiction. There's a city councilor who, during a meeting, participated in an evaluation of the counselor's daughter-in-law, who happened to be the city reporter, city staff, and it was an employment-related conversation, and she had also participated in a wage discussion and voted to increase the salary of the city recorder. The Ethics Commission found that the counselor violated the laws by failing to properly disclose the conflict. Like Jeremy said, it's easy. Aaron said a caution. This one, the disclosure.
So this next one is near and dear to my heart. I think it goes without saying, but again, going back to the city's history here, Oregon law prohibits public officials from using or attempting to use an official position or office to obtain financial gain or avoid financial detriment. Public officials may not use public equipment for personal purposes and or use information learned through confidential city documents obtained because of the position for financial gain. Not that you counselors have had issues with them, but I know that there's been other organizations, perhaps, that have used, let's say, equipment that was owned and controlled by a public institution for that individual's personal uses. That type of use, like a backhoe. If the city owned a backhoe and one of you wanted a well dug or whatever you want to do, want to do some improvements to your home, you couldn't go and drive it out there and utilize it. That would be a major issue. So
don't bring it back.
The flip side to that is, if you were to pay for it, however, that'd be a little bit different. But
pay
so
for services.
Yeah, pay for the work, pay for the services.
Just if like that any, was available.
If
too.
It was available,
I'll come run it for you.
Just like any other, just like any other individual in the public would be required to pay. There'd be no preferential treatment. And unfortunately, or fortunately, actually, there is no fortunately about it. Unfortunately, in smaller municipalities, this issue comes up all the time. And it's not just equipment and resources, it's human resources. We've had counselors that have directed city staff, not here, I'm saying, again, generally, we represent 11 different cities, so any one of them, who have directed their public official or their public works department to come out and do work on their property. That's a no-no. So, Stu, you got to stop doing that.
Send me a bill.
I think, again, it goes without saying, but sometimes we forget about that. In exchange of cash, so then the other component here is when there's some type of, exchange of value or cash for the vote on a particular issue. For example, when it comes to awarding a contract, we'll use a snow removal contract again. If one of our prospective contractors came to you and offered a sum of cash in exchange for supporting the award of a contract to that particular contractor, that would be a no-no. And you'd have personal exposure for that type of action or activity.
Final example to leave you with is kind of talking about a city official using that office for public gain or to avoid a detriment. Is another city councilor in Oregon, after being elected to city council, began calling the city planners, the city staff, about a house down the street that was being built that was too similar. You know, it was a copy home, and in an email, councilor wrote, "I believe this copy home will have a negative impact on the value of my home when I come to sell it." What was going on there is she was using her position as a city councilor to get the planner's ears to go in, and of course the planners and newly elected councilor wanted, you know, it was different than a member of the public, and point there was is she was using her office to go in and try and put a halt to this home that was going to have a detriment to the value of her home.
So that brings up the question that I have as far as the councilor commission relationship. Mm-hmm. What exactly is that as far as what's their role and what's our role when they bring when stuff goes to them first and then it comes to council?
Go ahead.
Well, so if there's been a land use action that's been called up to you, is that what you're kind of wondering about?
Well, so right now we have the
general process or
kind of because I don't think that everybody knows necessarily, but I'm thinking specifically there's, you know, something that I've heard a lot about in the public and that's coming up is the garage issue that that is on there. And I actually did attend a planning commission meeting because I had heard it out in the public quite a bit and I wanted to hear more.
Right.
I knew that it was going to be a controversial issue and I wanted to know more about it. And so I attended it and not knowing that I shouldn't attend it. But what happens if they come to us with a decision and we agree or disagree? It's opposite of what they come to us. What are
you're the ultimate authority on the issue, and so if they render a decision, I would say 90% of the time councils adhere to or dovetail on the decision, the advice, the direction of the planning commission. Every once in a while, the council will disagree with the planning commission decision, and you will basically reverse and decide otherwise. You're the ultimate authority, though, on these issues.
Yeah, and so likely what will happen, and it's played out a couple different ways, but in my time here at least, if there's an issue and city staff knows that we want to do X to solve that issue, or some variation of X to solve that issue, a staff report will be drafted, a lot of times working with legal, not necessarily these two on land use decisions. A lot of times we're working with Garrett or Sharon, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then Tammy will prepare a staff report that'll go to Planning Commission. If Planning Commission likes the way it's proposed and supports the policy and votes to send it to the City Council, Then staff will work with legal counsel to draft a formal ordinance that will then go to council and have at least one public hearing, possibly two, depending on if it's a unanimous vote and it was noticed appropriately, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of the general, and that'll play out over at least several months, maybe more than that, 6 months, could potentially. So I don't know if that kind of helped.
Okay, the council is the governing body.
Correct.
This is just, I just showed and I brought it up with Corey. Like, the council, we're going to use this as an example, the council was clueless on this. Like, we didn't know that this issue was being presented in front of the planning board for public knowledge.
Are you talking about the garage?
The garage.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, shouldn't at a work session we say, hey, what do you think about this, or not? Should the council even know about it?
Well, again, I don't have the history of the situation, so Corey, you're going to have to help. Help me a bit.
Well, and one thing that's difficult, too, is that this issue straddles an election and a completely different composition of the council. So this was set in motion in the fall.
Okay.
Not explicitly through a work session item and direction to go this way, but it was brought up that there's this issue, we want to look at how to solve that, and then through discussion amongst staff and legal counsel, the proposals were put together, and then they weren't brought, say, back to a council work session, they went to the planning commission.
Yeah.
So, is that a management type decision, or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, usually, it's all case by case, but sure. Usually issues like this, they're often discussed at a council work session level or at a city management level. City management would often apprise council, and again, it sounds like you guys, right between councils, and so it becomes very difficult for someone in Corey's position to communicate with the councils on an issue like this, but you apprise the council as to what's going on during a work session or during staff comments, even at the tail end of a meeting, and then it gets routed through the Planning Commission. Corey could tell the council while it's going through the Planning Commission process that, hey, be advised, there is this issue. It's currently being discussed and deliberated at the Planning Commission level. It will be brought to you on X and X date, and just, put you on notice.
Yeah.
But then you have a fresh set of eyes when it does come your way, and you'll have your opportunity to review. And if you need clarity or you don't like the decision, you can always send it back.
Well, it's just basically,
yeah, it's true.
Was the knowledge of it going on.
Yeah.
Because like Connie said, she got wind of it.
Yeah. Well,
we should have got wind of it at a council session.
Yeah, or yeah, work session, or even an email. And I don't know what, the communication, how you all, each city is different. But perhaps on certain issues, Corey could send out a quick email just generally summarizing the issue, what's going on, just put you on notice, keep you informed. That would be appropriate as well.
And the only reason I bring this up is future. I just want to...
Yeah.
Well, and there's one in the past where it went to the Planning Commission, or it was when we were rezoning. This had been several years ago. And the commission made a decision, and I asked, well, could I go to the meeting because I want to hear what's going on? I was told, no, don't go to the meeting because of, et cetera, the problems that we just explained. I said, well, when will we be able to comment it, meaning the council? And I was told it'll come back to you for final decision. It never came back to the council.
We're changing this.
This is not this last subject. This is another subject. So there's something was not happening right.
And I don't know, but your land use code could speak to the whole procedure there. And I don't know if there was an applicant for the zone?
Yes. It's all begun.
So it was all...
You're talking about our overall when we changed all the...
Yes.
All
there,
the...
There was a conditional use...
This was years ago.
Yeah, conditional land use permit was applied for.
So a conditional use doesn't go to the city council.
No, but it was changing the whole zoning.
Okay.
And it's up there by the high school.
A zone change or a comprehensive plan amendment would have to go to the city council.
It did.
Okay.
Moving forward.
Yeah. Well, just understand that your land use code speaks to what issues have to be presented to the council ultimately for approval. And generally speaking, not every land use decision has to go to the City Council. Some of it actually can be decided upon at the Planning Commission level, and you still, however, might serve as an appellate board. Okay. So if at the Planning Commission level, the applicant, perhaps, or proponents don't agree with the Planning Commission level, let's say there's a denial, your code generally would then allow you the opportunity to hear an appeal on that denial. Yeah.
And that could have been what happened there, is there was the opportunity that you were going to hear this, so in order to, and I don't know, maybe they didn't do it, but that could be the possibility that you were advised not to go just because there's a good possibility that you were going to be the appellate.
Right.
We're going to be hearing it 30 days from then. Yeah. So
we don't want to visit the past. We just want to think for your.
Well, and I'll add another layer on that. You know, I hear amongst all of you, as I should, and I think about it cognitively, that we should be prudent about how much money we spend, right? And so our contract planner, we pay by the hour, by her time. So on certain decisions that she's allowed to, she makes a decision administratively. It's not taken to the Planning Commission. If it's a controversial issue, we route it to the Planning Commission, or if it's an issue that has to go to the Planning Commission, obviously it goes to the Planning Commission. So that's another staff discretion that we've been opting on the side of it, making the decision administratively to save staff time in terms of public noticing and going through that process. So just a heads up on that as well.
Any other questions for us?
We're going on to our council stuff. Your Planning Commission, if you have anything else, get on Jerry. You're that or you're dismissed, but stay here if you want.
Okay.
Just while they're here, is there anything else?
Is there anything else? Questions at all you have?
Council, Planning Commission?
A lot to absorb.
You didn't know what you signed up for, is that what you're saying?
You've been saying that a lot lately, John.
Like I said, it's day 8.
Questions? Okay, no, I think they
anybody need a break or anything before we go to?
Why don't we have the Planning Commission adjourn their meeting and then we'll take a 5-minute break and we'll resume.
Okay. Do I have a motion to
adjourn?
I second it.
So
moved.
You know, all those
in favor. All those in favor. Well, he was already ahead of me.
I'm in favor. I'm in favor. We're
aye.
All in favor.
Say aye, Mary.
Aye.
You're learning that part fast.
If you want to say it,
well, that's why I say he needs to
just take a break
doing this because he's
I'll say something.
How long is this next one?
Yeah, I still got
a couple of questions.
How many people get in there?
Oh, okay.
That's the major thing.
Pretty basic.
You have to ask your accountant. I don't know. I don't know what your requirements or your limitations are, Karen.
Just put more work on your list.
You have an accountant that helps you all, correct?
Yeah.